For the week of October 2nd, 2011, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 121, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And at the Swedish Academy in Stockholm, I'm Michael Gills.
You're at the Swedish Academy, so are you there to find out whether, was it the gentleman from, the scientist from, I can't remember where he's from, but he passed away a day before they awarded the Nobel Prize in medicine or physics or some science, and now they're wondering, is he eligible to win since he had passed away?
No, we've moved on from that. I'm more interested in the Nobel Prize for Literature, which will be announced on Thursday.
Oh, okay. And is there somebody that's up for it? I mean, is there a short list, so to speak?
Well, there's no official short list, but you do have bookies in London taking bets on who will win this year, including a female writer from North Africa that they think might be in the spirit of the times as far as the Arab uprising. There are, you know, people like Philip Roth and Haruki Murakami, who are always mentioned. But, you know, I'm here at the Academy. It's a crazy scene, as always. There are fans lining the streets. They're all dressed up to cheer on their favorite authors. You can see the Philip Roth fans. They're bunched together to represent a human stain. And the fans of the Syrian opponent, Adonis, who is the front runner, according to the British bookies, they're rather good looking, I must say. And then the fans of Haruki Murakami are reenacting scenes from his last novel, Kafka on the Shore. He has a new book out just now called 1984, or rather IQ84, which is sort of a spin on George Orwell's 1984. But before that came Kafka on the Shore, which is a rather depressing novel. But there is a little controversy, as there is every year. Across the street in a penned-up section and being guarded by the cops are protesters who insist that the Swedish Academy members who vote on the Nobel Prize for Literature, about 18 people in all, are muggles, and that J.K. Rowling should have won the Nobel Prize years ago.
Yeah, that generally isn't the way it works. I hate
Right. Well, they're kind of violent, but I don't think we'll see a repeat of the violence that occurred last year when a bludger was intentionally released by a Quidditch fanatic from Oxford. So hopefully things will remain more peaceful this year.
I hope so. But actually, I have a funny story to relay, and you're the first person I'm telling this to. So
what's it about?
Well, I was dropping my kids off at preschool today, and actually kindergarten, I should say. And now, that's normally not the start of a very entertaining story. However, as I'm dropping them off at kindergarten, I kind of see out of the corner of my eye these two buff guys standing outside, and I kind of overhear one of them saying something, oh, yeah, no, that's an old military slang, blah, and I thought to myself, you know, I guess they could have been in the military at one point, you know, before they decided to settle down and have families. I mean, their short-cropped hair kind of says that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that all happened in about 2 seconds of thought. So then I'm walking the kids to the classroom, and I see this couple standing at the top of the stairs overlooking the play yard. And, you know, the guy's got his arm around the girl, and I kind of, for some reason, his jeans caught my eye, and I thought, oh, what a poser. Look at those jeans. They probably cost $200-$300. I mean, look at all that bedazzling and stuff. He's probably, you know, in the entertainment industry of some kind. I mean, look, from the side, he looks just like Mark Anthony, that singer guy that was married to Jennifer Lopez. And and that woman actually looks a lot like, actually is, Jennifer Lopez.
So they were there seeing their kids off to school?
I guess so. I don't know why they thought school started in October, but the two guys out front were two of the bodyguards, two of, I counted, 6 to 8 bodyguards.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's a lot of bodyguards. I guess that's what's needed at that level of fame.
Yeah, well, and it changed the whole demeanor of the school.
Everybody stayed in line at the cafeteria. Nobody tried to cut.
Exactly. Well, you know, we're not going to be talking to Jennifer Lopez or Mark Anthony on today's show, but we are going to be speaking with Sean Berkusen, and I hope I'm pronouncing his name right. He is the CEO of Prescreen, a new movie marketing and distribution platform that helps filmmakers and distributors reach new audiences. And speaking of movies, Sony Pictures dropped a bombshell on movie theater chains last week when they said they'd no longer pay for 3D glasses. Everybody is in an uproar, not just movie theaters, over Facebook's new open graph sharing tools. But they could be a boon for record labels. Just ask Spotify. The new television season is in its second week, and we'll tell you why NBC isn't canceling some of the series that are underperforming. Of course, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop, and end with some correspondence from some of our listeners, Michael. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz, who will fill us in on the weekend's box office if he hasn't been reading too many books over there in Stockholm.
Well, I will cover the worldwide box office. It was one of the slowest weeks overseas in years at the box office. So very soft weekend around the world. We're just, of course, segueing from summer into fall. But the number one movie around the world is Dolphin Tale, the family film that's opened basically here in the U.S. only. It's at $14.2 million this weekend and has reached $37 million total and counting. The number two movie at the box office worldwide is Moneyball, which grossed another $12.5 million. So it dropped about 40%. So it's at $38 million total worldwide. It still hasn't opened overseas, and it's about baseball, so we'll have to see how that does.
It's a great movie, though. I mean, watching the movie, I thought, gosh, you know, Aaron Sorkin could have written this. Turns out he did.
I wasn't as big a fan of it, but there you go. At number three is The Lion King 3D, which grossed another $11 million worldwide. It's at just a smidgen under $100 million so far in this go-around, and its total take from all its theatrical runs is $883 million worldwide. You wanted to jump in about the U.S. total?
Well, actually, the only thing I have to say about the U.S. total is that it now is, I guess it's past the $400 million mark U.S., mm-hmm. And so it is now the number 10 top. It's in the top 10, and it is number 10 in for domestic releases as far as
right of all time top releases in North America. The Lion King has now edged into the top 10. I think it joins two other animated films, Toy Story 3 and Shrek 2. Those are the three animated films in the top 10. Number one, of course, is Avatar. Number two is Titanic. And it's, you know, one of the biggest hits of all time. At number four worldwide is a combination animation and live action film, The Smurfs, starring our friend
Neil Patrick Harris.
Thank you. It grossed $10.7 million worldwide. This is the eighth weekend. It's been at number one at the box office overseas, so it's really doing well. It's at $520 million worldwide total.
Eight weekends at number one. I mean, that's pushing like Avatar success.
Yes, that's really a significant success story. At number five is 50-50, the cancer comedy movie starring Joseph Gordon-Levitt, one of my favorite actors. It grossed $8.8 million in a North American debut only. At number six is Courageous, which also grossed $8.8 million, basically in North America. This is a Christian-based film. It's from the people behind Fireproof and a series of other Christian-based movies that are marketed first to Christian audiences. Fireproof starred Kirk Cameron. It was about firefighters. This movie, Courageous, is about cops. It cost $2 million to make. It grossed $8.8 million on its opening weekend. This is the fourth film from a company called Sherwood Productions, and every film has grossed more money on its opening weekend than the movie before. So they continue to really build a good track record for themselves. It was co-written, directed, and stars Alex Kendrick in a story about cops who turn to their faith when tragedy strikes.
It just goes to show you, though, how important niche marketing can be. When it comes to these types of films.
When you reach an audience that hasn't seen their story told on screen or feels like they have an insatiable desire for it, you can really, if you make a movie for the right price, you can really score.
And you know how to reach them. I mean, just in church every Sunday, you can, you know, promote and market the film.
That's right. And they do, of course, have a lot of outreach with churches, but they're also making better and better movies. And that's the important thing. I think on CinemaScore, it has an A-plus rating. The people who went and saw it loved it. At number seven worldwide is Friends with Benefits, which grossed another $8.5 million. And number eight is the James Bond spoof, Johnny English Reborn, which grossed $8.4 million. It opens in North America on October 28th. And number nine is a U.S. debut, Dreamhouse. It grossed $8.2 million and has to be considered a disappointment.
I mean, it got 5% rating on Rotten Tomatoes, which I know you can't go just by Rotten Tomatoes and you shouldn't necessarily, but they didn't screen the movie for critics, so that should tell you something. And with Cowboys and Aliens and this particular disaster, Daniel Craig stars in both of those films. And you know what? Is he a box office draw beyond the James Bond movies?
Well, he's certainly having a bad summer.
That's true, yes.
But nobody can draw, I shouldn't say nobody, but it's hard to draw people to a movie that's bad.
That's true,
so
too.
The real question is whether you're in a good movie and can't bring people in. You know, he will be in The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo in Christmas. That will certainly be a very big test of his draw. It's a big title. It's a, you know, a big novel. The novel will be the draw. People say, oh, Daniel Craig didn't draw people. But he's the lead. He has a bigger lead, frankly, than The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. He's in most of that film. If he doesn't carry that film, it's not going to be a success story long term. So that's going to be a real big, you know, test of his appeal.
Yeah.
At number 10 is another very interesting film. It's Silenced. We talked about this last week. This is the South Korean film about frightening events at a school for the deaf. It was number one last week in South Korea. It's number one this week and increases its take. Last week it grossed $6.2 million. This weekend it grosses $7 million. It's number one at the box office again in South Korea and number 10 worldwide. That's turning into a really interesting success story. At number 11 is Fast Five, which you probably considered had to have been long gone, but it's finally opening in Japan, where it's obviously a big draw. It grossed $6.6 million, and the movie is now at $616 million worldwide total. At number 12 is Crazy Stupid Love at $6.4 million. At number 13 is the Taylor Lautner film Abduction, basically open only in North America. It goes to $5.6 million, dropped quite a bit. It's at $90 million total, and it costs $35 million to make. So they made the movie at the right price, but they still weren't able to deliver with Taylor Lautner.
That's true. Yeah, and I think that, you know, when you say it costs $35 million to make, it probably cost another 10 or 15 to market. So
certainly, it was a solid marketing campaign, so at least $10 to $15 million. But that's always, you know, part of a wide release. But, you know, the budget was not huge, but it didn't deliver. I think Taylor Lautner has a lot more to worry about than Daniel Craig.
Good point.
At number 14 is another flop, What's Your Number?, the Anna Faris comedy about a woman looking at the last 20 guys she dated and wondering maybe if she missed Mr. Right. You know, did he slip through her fingers? It opened at $5.6 million in North America. At number 15 is Contagion, another $5 million. It still has an overseas campaign to go, but right now it's at $64 million. At number 16 is The Three Musketeers, which has been opening overseas. It grossed $4.9 million. It's made $20 million worldwide so far, and it stars Logan Lerman as D'Artagnan. He's the star of the Percy Jackson movies and has a couple other upcoming films. People seem to think he's a star. He keeps getting big roles. We'll have to see if he can actually deliver soon. At number 17 is Killer Elite, the De Niro film, which did not do well. It grossed $4.8 million, and both Drive and The Help scored another $3 million in North America. So that's it from the worldwide box office.
I guess Drive is being considered somewhat of a failure, even though it's a good movie. I know you didn't like it when we saw it in Cannes, but it got rave reviews, and it just didn't perform very well at the box office.
Oh, I don't know about that. I mean, it's a very modestly budgeted film, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's already made its money back.
Well, then that's a success.
That's what I say. I mean, there was a piece on IndieWire last week saying, you know, why it failed. And I thought, well, I don't get why somebody would say it's failing other than the fact that, you know, when you say it's going to cost somewhere between $40 million and it hasn't actually made that back, that I can see.
It cost $15 million to make, and it's grossed $27 million in North America. I think if there's any sense, it's that it got such good reviews, they thought maybe it would break out and be a big, big hit. But if you see the film, it's not actually an action film. It's not a very thrilling, you know, action-packed adventure. It's a quiet, psychological drama, basically. There's some action. There's some little things. But it's not a big pow-pow movie that's going to pack them in. It's a sort of an art film.
Yes, absolutely.
So, you know, more credit to them. They made it for the right price. They sold it. They got people to see it. And I'm sure it'll be on a fair number of critics' end of the year list.
Well, I know that a lot of people were surprised that Dolphin Tale took over the top spot, took it away from Lion King here in the U.S. But frankly, Lion King, which dropped 50%, it doesn't surprise me. The movie came out on Blu-ray just this past week. So
no, it comes out on Tuesday.
Or comes out on Tuesday. You know, and it's ending its run, I think, or it ended its run yesterday on Sunday. Kind of a weird
thing. Well, they're thinking it'll stay in theaters at least another week. Theater owners still want to keep it in because it's making money. So even though it's coming out on, you know, this new elaborate edition, their sense is, look, the movie's been available on DVD for years. So why pull it? People are going to the theaters to see it. You can't duplicate that Blu-ray 3D experience. You can't duplicate the 3D experience at home very easily. Most people can't do it at all. So they're offering something you can't get on that new edition, which looks spectacular, I must add. I have the DVD right now. But, you know, they're saying, hey, they don't think it's going to impact it at all. So they're going to try it for another week. It was scheduled to end, but they want to keep it in theaters for another week because it's still pulling them in.
And theater owners are okay with that, even though they might wind up paying for the glasses?
This is a fascinating issue. Why don't you set it up?
Well, it's something I covered for Celluloid Junkie this past week. Shameless plug there, by the way. And I guess the way you could look at it is, studios since 2005, when they first started showing 3D movies with Chicken Little, Disney decided that they would pay for the 3D glasses that customers need to wear to see them. Now, there's a whole other inside reason why that's the case, but all of the other studios followed suit, and they always blamed Disney for that.
Well, weren't they pressuring theater owners to spend a lot of money to upgrade their theaters so they could handle 3D films?
Well, yes, you do need digital projectors and digital servers. You know, this isn't a 35 millimeter 3D. This is a completely different technology. And so what wound up happening there is studios are paying virtual print fees to the exhibitors to show digital films, so whether it's 2D or 3D. Now, of course, the savings for showing a digital film where you don't need 35 millimeter film and you don't need to make all of these expensive prints, that savings goes to distributors. So exhibitors said, all these movie theater owners said, well, why would we pay more money for equipment that we don't need that doesn't save us any money? Studios came in and said, all right, we will pay for the projectors and the servers, but we won't pay for any of the 3D equipment, any of the 3D technology. So Real-D or Dolby or Master Image, any of that 3D stuff you have to pay for on your own.
Okay, and theaters said, all right, or at least they caved and they did it anyway. But Disney stepped in and said, oh, but we will pay for the glasses, because that can be a serious expense. It can be like $5 to $10 million worldwide for a major theatrical release.
Right, they're saying it costs about 50 cents per pair of glasses. And these are the non-active or passive glasses, the plastic ones that get recycled at the end of the film. So Real-D, of course, is the one that everybody would think of, not Dolby, where exhibitors are paying for those glasses anyway.
So what made Sony suddenly announce that next summer, starting in May 1st, they would stop paying for 3D glasses?
Well, first of all, these studios have wanted to ditch this for some time. They don't want to be paying $5 to $10 million for glasses, or even, you know, $1 to $2 million for kind of a smaller or regular 3D release. And Fox tried to do it back in 2009 when Ice Age 3, Dawn of the Dinosaurs was released, and movie theater owners freaked out, so they had to kind of pull back a little bit and say, no, we'll continue to pay. But it's no secret that studios have wanted to get rid of this whole paying for 3D glasses thing for some time. Now, of course, Sony has two movies coming out in the summer of 2012, and this new edict from Sony says we won't pay for them past May 1st, 2012. They have The Amazing Spider-Man opening on May 12th, and Men in Black 3 opening on May 25th. Very convenient for Sony to decide May 1st as the date.
But what I don't understand is, first of all, NATO got very upset. That's the North American theater owners. They sent out an angry letter to Sony saying, hey, you need to reconsider this. And they mocked Sony for claiming that they wanted to work with theaters, which I have to agree with. Sony put out a statement saying, hey, we want to work with theater owners. And this is after, of course, they unilaterally said, hey, we're doing this, drop dead, but hey, let's work together.
Right. And the thing is that other studios, all the studios can't get together and say, this is what we're doing. We're not going to pay for 3D glasses anymore, because that, you know, kind of treads on antitrust issues. So one studio, Sony, says they're not going to pay. Everybody else watches what's going to happen. And mark my words, you'll see everybody start doing this. Every studio will stop paying if Sony gets away with this.
But what my big issue is, theater owners and studios are fighting over who's going to pay for this. Aren't theater goers paying for this? We already pay a $3 premium, and I know the theater wants to keep every penny of that, or they split that with the studio, whatever
right.
The breakdown is. So aren't they just going to say, fine, instead of $3 per 3D film, we're going to charge $3.50. It'll be consumers that pay it, not the theater owners and not the distributors.
Right, but I mean, at this point, consumers are already ticked off that they're paying an extra $3. They've gotten tired of paying that extra $3. And are
Tell me about it.
They're making conscious decisions not to see a film in 3D.
Though we don't want to over-exaggerate it, I'm all for that and agree with it, and you can see that happen. But they're still going to 3D movies and paying that premium. It's a substantial, you know, extra little bump that they're getting for movies in 3D. You know, 40% of people go see it in 3D. Well, that's 40% of tickets sold with an extra $3 tacked onto them.
Right, and certainly the studios are saying, look, we don't want this $5 to $10 in operating expense for every movie we release. And what I find interesting is, you think exhibitors do? I mean, what, right. You think they're just going to swallow $5 to $10 million? You're not willing to swallow it for your own movie. Why should the exhibitors be willing to swallow it to sell your movie?
So what's more likely, that exhibitors will simply raise the price of 3D or say, hey, we'll show in 2D?
I think that some exhibitors, like Regal, have said, look, we're just going to show more 2D films. You know, if you're not going to pay for the glasses, guess what? We're going to play it in 2D. And Regal is big enough to actually move the entire market. I mean, they have 6,000 some odd screens here in North America. That's not an idle threat.
Right, but why? If they get an extra $3 per ticket and $1.50 goes to the studio and they get $1.50, they're getting an extra dollar. Even if it costs 50 cents per glass, they're still getting an extra dollar. Why would they give up an extra dollar per ticket for 3D sales?
That extra dollar is going to pay for the 3D technology in the booth, not for the glasses.
Which they've already paid for and they need to pay for.
Well, they have to continue paying for that.
They can't throw it out, and they can't throw out the 3D technology and say we're done paying for it. They've already committed to the 3D technology. They have it there in the theater, and now they're going to give up an extra dollar in income despite the studios. I don't see that. I wish they would, don't get me wrong, but it doesn't make any sense. I think it's a threat, but it doesn't make any sense to me. If people are willing to pay it, why give up that extra dollar, especially since you've already got the equipment to pay for?
Because, you know, when you're in business, you're trying to prevent, you know, and watch your expenses and prevent expenses from rising at any cost. So this is kind of a stand that the exhibitors are going to have to take, and it's a stand that the studios are going to have to take. And this was my solution for it over at Celluloid Junkie was, you know, a lot of people said, here's what's going to happen. You're going to have movie theater owners, instead of splitting it 50-50 for a 3D film, they'll split it 45-60 or 55. So they'll keep 55% of it to pay for the 3D glasses. I don't think that's going to happen because studios don't want movie theater owners to get in the habit of lowering film rental and getting used to a lower film rental.
Well, they want more money. Why let them keep it? If they lose $10 million that way, it's just as bad as losing $10 million by paying for the glasses.
Well, it's even worse because in the case of, you know, getting a lower film rental, well, there are people like Steven Spielberg and Tom Cruise and all of these people who get profit participation on net grosses who would say, wait a second, you just gave away 5% of what could have been a net profit for me. And you're asking me to take a lower upfront fee and then you're going to pay me on the back end. You just lowered the back end.
Yeah, and Spielberg has Tintin coming up, which of course will be in 3D.
Right, so...
And stars Daniel Craig.
My feeling would be, okay, if you're going to make the exhibitors pay for it, and the exhibitors don't want to pass that cost along to the customers, and I can understand that, the way to make it transparent to customers might be to say, okay, we will split the film rental on the 2D version, 50-50, just as it always has been, and it's 50-50 give or take, you know, every film is different. And we will keep the entire upcharge of the $3 for ourselves. That's what the exhibitors could say.
I don't understand. How can they unilaterally say we're going to keep part of the ticket price?
Well, because that part of the ticket price is there to pay for the glasses and for the would-be. If the exhibitors paid for glasses, it would be there to pay for the glasses and the 3D technology in the booth.
Well, how will that satisfy the studios? The studios say, hey, we don't want to pay 50 cents per glass. And the theaters say, fine, we're keeping the entire $3 premium.
They're no longer paying $5 to $10 million for the movie, for the glasses.
They've just lost their chunk of that. They've lost more than that.
Yeah, that's probably true. So they'll continue to pay for the glasses. Plus, you know,
this is what you think they should threaten to do.
Yeah, well, plus, I think when you really look at it, Sony, Paramount, Fox, all of these studios, they buy these glasses in such bulk that it only costs 50 cents. If Regal or any of these other movie theaters were to purchase these glasses, that price would start to go up.
Why?
Because they're not buying millions of them. They're buying hundreds of thousands of them.
I thought there were like three big chains that dominated and they'd be able to buy in bulk anyway.
Yeah, they probably would. But not all of the exhibitors could.
So who's the big loser? First of all, I think it's theater goers who will probably get hit at some point with higher 3D premium prices. Not that that won't be a disaster, but it looks like Real D is also a big loser.
That's true. And IMAX stock plunged. I mean, Real D.
Why did IMAX stock plunge?
They don't know and nobody knows because they're not affected by this decision at all. And they even released a statement saying, hey, guys, we're not in this thing. So
don't they show a lot of movies in IMAX screens on 3D and, you know. Yeah. I mean, they're not IMAX movies technically, but they use their IMAX screens for premium viewing of movies and 3D movies.
Yeah, I don't understand why, but, you know, their stock price dropped. The Hollywood Reporter didn't understand why. IMAX didn't understand why. Real D, which is a 3D company and makes this 3D technology, I think they have about 90% of the market share. Their share should have dropped because of this, and they did about 15% over the course of 2 days. I think 18% total by the end of the week. Their stock price is down close to 70% on the year.
Well, and they had fallen in the summer because it turned out in Europe where they sell moviegoers the glasses. They say, here, you got to buy your glasses. And it turned out that people were keeping the glasses and bringing them back to the next movie they saw rather than paying for them over and over again. Of course, why wouldn't they?
Right.
And so the fact that they were not going to be able to sell a glass for every single screening of every single movie meant that they anticipated a lot lower sales down the road in the UK and Europe overall. So their stock, I think it fell like 20% in one day after they disclosed that.
It's interesting because I think a lot of the exhibitors internationally are looking at the US and saying, guys, you know, man up here. We've been paying for these glasses since day one and you guys have been, you know, getting these glasses from the studios. So we've been paying that $5 to $10 million per film.
I would have freaked out if I walk into a theater and they tried to charge me every single time I go to a movie that I have to pay for the glasses, especially since you know, it's hard to bring them back because you don't know what theaters use what glasses. So how do you know what's compatible? I guess it's usually 3D.
Right. And those are the passive glasses. They're a little cheaper. They have, you know, the circular polarization. And Sony kept saying, well, you know, now, you know, for the environment, people will actually go out and spend money on premium glasses that the exhibitors can sell. And so that's an additional revenue item for them. And I agree with you. Because different theaters have different technologies, 3D technologies, you have no idea what pair of glasses is going to be used in a particular theater. And I brought my own pair of 3D glasses to go see Avatar, and in the end, I couldn't use them because Dolby was being used. So,
yeah, and theater owners will probably get upset if you brought them in. You know, and you're supposed to remember to bring like 4 bulky pairs of glasses for your family to the movie, you know.
Or remember where they are in your house for the right. You know, one time. Yeah, I mean, that just it doesn't work.
And I hate 3D.
Well, nope. You know, I went to see Moneyball over the weekend at an AMC theater in Woodland Hills, and 5-10 minutes into the movie, I said, gosh, this is really dark. I mean, maybe that's the way it was shot. It was shot by Wally Pfister, and he's kind of he likes the grain, the film grain, and he has this kind of interesting way of lighting things. I thought, well, it's probably just the way it was shot. But just in case, I'm going to look behind me and see if there are 2 images coming out of the projection booth instead of just 1. Because, of course, if there are 2 images coming out, that means it's being shown through a 3D lens on the projector,
and thus it's being ruined by showing at a much murky lower lighting level.
That is correct. And sure enough, it was being shown through a 3D lens.
This is really George Lucas stepped in. How many years ago was it? Was it the 80s?
1999.
That's when he did THX.
Oh no, he did that in the 80s.
Right, he did. You know, he stepped in and said, you know what? He went into movie theaters and saw really poor projection, really poor sound, and he came up with the THX label. And if you wanted to boast that you're a THX certified theater, you had to have state-of-the-art projection and sound. And somebody needs to step in and do that again, because way too many theaters are screwing up how they show movies.
Theater owners hated that, by the way. They hated it. And guess what? Where is THX now? You know, they're nowhere.
No, it worked so well, it became outdated because everybody had to step up their game. I used to seek out THX theaters, and everybody had you for a while there, you were getting much better picture and sound in theaters. You get stadium seating everywhere. You have the capability of much better picture and sound. Everybody's got the surround, you know, the 5.1 or the multi-channel sound. Everybody has that capability. The problem today is that they've gotten lazy again, and they're not making proper use of it. They're not training their staff, and they're not projecting films properly. And it really, somebody needs to step in and fix this. I don't know why NATO doesn't do it, because they're destroying their industry and the reputation.
Right. And I actually spoke with the manager after seeing Moneyball, and I asked him, you know, how long does it take to change out a 3D lens? And he said, well, about a day and a half, because we have to get the guys in and they have to do
it. Oh my God.
Yeah. I mean, I just thought, well, that's part of the problem. But
a day and a half, that's insane that they would build it that way.
Well,
there's another problem.
Yeah. Well, it's more a matter of operations, you know, having to call somebody, having to have that person come out. It's like calling the cable guy. You got to wait.
But you know when you need it. You know on Thursday you need it because you've got the new movie coming in on Friday.
Well, not always, because sometimes you move films from theater to theater.
That's insane that you would have a technology that would not allow you to go back and forth so easily.
Well,
whoever designed that, that's a huge problem.
Well, it wasn't necessarily designed that way as much as that's the way AMC operates.
But it seems to be trouble for everybody. Everybody says it's very complicated, very difficult, takes a long time, at least a couple hours. It's clearly a it's not as simple as snapping off one lens and putting it on another.
No, but neither is it on a 35 millimeter projector either. So,
all right. So they always need trained professionals.
Exactly. Well, and now they're trying to get away.
I'm not the only one who's frustrated with 3D, am I?
No, you're not. Because over in the UK, apparently a YouGov survey have said that 3D movies are a gimmick.
I'm with you. So, even the best 3D movie projection I've seen does not make me go, oh my God, it's like color or sound. No, to me, it's not.
Right. Well, and they did a survey of 2,796 adults, which was weighted to represent the British adult population as a whole. And there are all these interesting figures that came out of it. 22% of British cinema goers feel that 3D improves the cinema experience, whereas 47% either thought 3D made no difference or made it worse. And just 19% feel that 3D improves the quality of a film, but 41% think that the 3D is just a gimmick.
Well, you're confusing me.
Let me throw a few more numbers at you.
22% think it improves the cinema, which means 78% of people don't.
Right, precisely.
All right. About half the people think it makes no difference or makes it worse. So they're paying money for something that makes it worse in their opinion.
Right.
And okay. All right. So do people want to see it in, if it's in both formats at the same time and for the same price? Less than half of the people said they would choose to see a movie in 3D.
Right, 47%.
And 37% said they would see, this makes no sense either. Less than 2 in 5 said they would view it in 2D, which means 20% decided to go to dinner, I guess.
I guess. I don't know.
The general takeaway is that people in the UK are suspicious of 3D, don't feel like they're getting their money's worth.
That's right. And I think the same is true here in the United States and all over the world.
Well, it's been doing better overseas. We're sort of ahead of the curve here in the US where people are starting to resist a little bit. And sometimes you get trapped to see a 3D movie because the 2D is not showing then. Or 80% of the screens are devoted to 3D and you have no choice. So Sperling, what's your prediction a year from now? You know the distribution industry much better than I do. What's going to happen? Are they just going to raise 3D prices and make people pay for it? Are the owners and distributors going to be able to come to some sort of happy agreement? Is 3D going to be on a serious decline where the, you know, people are going to treat it like a gimmick and it's going to fade away? What's going to go on?
Well, I think that first off, I should say that I am in no way a prognosticator in that regard, because if I could tell you what was going to happen, then I'd be a multimillionaire. But I can say that studios have always wanted to get rid of this paying for the 3D glasses. They don't do it anywhere else in the world. So more than likely, they will not be paying for 3D glasses for much longer. And exhibitors will have to swallow it. Now, will exhibitors then pass that cost along to consumers? Well, if there's enough of a hubbub made about it and consumers understand why that cost is rising, thanks to the studios, then maybe. But more than likely, they won't be able to do that because people are already upset over the high prices of 3D movies.
All right. Well, prognostication is a game everyone gets to play, so we'll have to see if you're right.
Well, I didn't make any predictions about the television season, this new television season. None of the shows did I didn't make one single prediction other than that maybe Pan Am wouldn't do very well, or that the Playboy Club wouldn't do very well because they are kind of ripoffs of Mad Men. And the Playboy Club isn't doing very well, and you said it was boring. It's got a 1.0 share, which is horrible. And you know what? It's not going to be canceled.
Well, it's not being canceled. It's first week out.
That's true. I should say that. Yeah, Bob Greenblatt, who has taken over NBC as its chairman, is going to give all freshman shows more time to send a message to the creative community that he will give their shows on NBC a chance.
Yeah, keep going.
Why, you don't think that's true?
Well, the simple fact is that NBC is in complete meltdown. They have one show in the top 30, Sunday Night Football plus the pregame show. They have in the opening week of the fall television season, I'm just double checking, football, Sunday Night Football was number 2 with 20 million people.
It doesn't matter.
20 million people. And way down towards the bottom of the top 30 was Football Night in America Part 3, which also was in the top 30. That's it. They have no shows in the top 30. He's not canceling these shows because he has to replace every show on every night, practically. NBC has no good news from any of the new fall shows. They don't have enough shows to replace everything. So you can't just start dumping shows day one because you have nothing to put in their place.
Right. And these aren't his shows because he took over after these shows piloted and were decided upon. And, he's giving Playboy Club a chance at least for a little while because he's got nothing else. And, I wish that Terra Nova was on NBC because then it might actually be a show that lasts. Did you see this show?
I did. I watched the pilot.
And the pilot was 2 hours long. It was practically a movie. And it's a show that I guess it's science fiction, Lost, yeah, kind of combined. It's
people in a future where the environment has melted down and you have to wear masks just to go outdoors and everybody's forced to have just 2 children because we can't afford any more overcrowding. They are sent back in time to start over again.
85, was it million or billion years?
I think million, but yeah. it's not to start over again in our time. It's a new time stream. So they're going to start a new future, a new civilization for a new future and try to get it right. They're not going to affect our present because that would be disastrous, as everybody who reads science fiction knows. So what they're going to do is start a brand new future, but there's also shadowy reasons. We don't know what's going on. So you've got the going back in time, you've got dinosaurs, people trying to start a new life in a strange world, but you've also got the lost sense of that other ABC show where you're trying to figure out what exactly is the super plot going on here. What future are they going to try to start? Who's trying to manipulate it? What's going on?
Right. And I think Mark Berman said that it doesn't feel like a long-lived series. It feels like more of a short-lived series. It's not going to last. It didn't premiere
very
well.
Is that what he said?
Yeah.
Mark Berman. I thought you meant a producer on the show.
No. Mark Berman, you know, from TV Media Insights, he just doesn't – it did not – the ratings weren't that good. They weren't horrible, but they weren't great. And
I thought it was a watchable pilot.
Yeah, it was, you know, like Land of the Lost meets Lost.
Well, with a lot better than Land of the Lost. But yeah,
right.
It was a decent pilot. It wasn't great. I'll probably dip in another episode or two. I don't strongly recommend it. But for family viewing, it was perfectly watchable.
Yeah, I guess it's on Monday nights. I would recommend it. I think it's – I couldn't believe that show was on television. I mean, it must have cost a mint to make that show.
The pilot cost, like, I think $15 to $18 million. It was a 2-hour pilot, very expensive. Obviously, week to week, they're going to have to keep costs lower. But if you sell it all over the world and sell it on DVD, you can make your money.
Right. You don't have to pay for all those sets again. So, of course, in future episodes, it will.
But you do need to pay for the dinosaurs.
That's true. And those dinosaurs, I mean, it was like Jurassic Park meets Lost. That is the best way to describe it.
That's right. But the only reason NBC is not canceling shows left and right is because they can't. They have no good news on any night of the week. Then if you look at the top 30 of the premium demos, that's the 18 to 34-year-olds that advertisers really want, they have two more shows, which are The Office and the show that follows it, Whitney, which is also a disaster in the ratings. Thursday night is down. Every night is just awful, awful news for NBC. It makes me sad because it was my favorite network growing up. It was Hill Street Blues,
LA
Cheers.
Law.
Yeah, Cosby Show, St. Elsewhere, all those things. NBC was quality to me.
Well, that's so when Brandon Tartikoff ran the network.
That's right. So it's very sad to see where it's at today.
Right. And, you know, one way that networks may be gauging the success of their shows, or at least the future success of their shows, is through social media and social engagement. And I guess Glee, the ratings are dropping off a bit. And Ad Age had this story about Trender, which is a social media monitoring firm. And they launched this site called Trender.tv, and they measure the amount of mentions, whether positive or negative, of a specific show. And I guess it was down 10% from its premiere rating, and it was 29% from last season's premiere. And their tweet volume dropped 200,000.
Try to put this in context. I'm confused. Dropped 200,000 from what?
Well, last year, I guess the season premiere of Glee garnered more than 500,000 tweets the day it aired, and this year's premiere had roughly, you know, 300,000 tweets.
So that's a big, big drop. That's almost like, that's like 40%, almost 50%. That's a huge drop. And of course, a show like Glee is one you would expect to be very strong in Twitter and other social media accounts because there's a lot of young people. So tracking that makes a lot more sense for Glee than, say, NCIS, which probably went from 10 tweets last season to 8 tweets this season.
Right, exactly.
Because grandma don't tweet.
That's right. Well, and we should probably get the people from Trender on just to find out what they're doing with this Trender.tv service. And on all these check-in services, I'm a little confused by GetGlue and Miso and on all these services where you check in to watching a TV show. I don't get the appeal of them. But apparently this whole idea of social recommendations, or as Mark Zuckerberg would say, a real-time serendipity. I still don't necessarily know what that means. It's kind of been in the news lately because of what Facebook did. And they launched Open Graph, which is this technology that allows people to...
I don't know what this is at all. You have to explain it to me.
Well, Open Graph is a way for people to share what they're doing literally live. So if you are on Spotify, for instance, and you're listening to a song, it will share the song you're listening to all of your friends over on Facebook. And they can then start listening to Spotify. And in fact, they can listen to the same song and you could be listening together. Well,
how often is that going to be useful?
Well, apparently it's quite useful. And, you know, I've actually watched, on that little ticker that they now have on the side of Facebook, I've seen a bunch of friends, the music that they're listening to, and I've kind of clicked on a few and said, oh, that's an interesting band. So it's a way to discover music that you may not have known about.
If you go onto Facebook and see what your friends are listening to and check it out.
Yeah, the problem is, of course, that that little ticker moves so fast that if you started listening to something now, in 15, 20, 30 seconds, it's gone and I don't see what you're listening to anymore.
Can you go backwards and forwards? And can you just say, I want to look at this friend and what they're doing?
I think you can in their new timeline that they're creating and have yet to actually release to the public. But there was a big uproar about this whole thing because, first off, Spotify changed the way you log in. You have to have a Facebook account now.
If you're a new user.
If you're a new user. And they say, unfortunately, you will need a Facebook account to access Spotify from now on unless you already have an account set up. This does not stop you from creating a Facebook account, adding nothing to it, and making it totally private, as the Facebook account does not have to be actively used. So then why
would Spotify limit themselves to only Facebook users? Is that a part of their agreement with Facebook?
I'm sure that there was some, you know, tit for tat there. And you look, they've got Facebook has 800 million people using it. And if you're Spotify and you want, you know, 800 million people to see that Michael Giltz is listening to XYZ on Spotify, well, that's the way to do it.
First, I'd have to download Spotify.
Right. And I gave you an account. You know, I sent you an invite. So, but now everybody can download Spotify and become a member. You know what really irks me about Spotify is that I paid the $5 to be like a pseudo premium member. And now everybody who's getting the free version gets to be a...
Everything you did.
Everything plus you get to use it on mobile. I'm like, oh, thanks. Yeah. I guess, you know, chop off the heads of your early adopters. That's nice.
Well, back to Open Graph, is there any use other than music?
I mean, movies, books.
Like what? Like if you're watching a movie on iTunes, you can show them or you choose to show them, or how does it work?
Well, you
does
would
it just
click
spy
on, the-
on you and just show everything you're doing online? I don't understand. I don't want people to see me streaming some adult site.
Right. And so that was the big thing, because Spotify, you know, all the users of Spotify were saying, wait a second, this is an invasion of my privacy. I want everybody seeing every song I listen to. I listen to a lot of Madonna. I listen to a lot of Britney Spears. I don't want all my friends knowing that. And so Spotify had to kind of retreat a little bit and say, well, okay, you know, we'll make it so that you can do, you know, a private listening mode, or you
that
can.
That wasn't built in. They had to go back and change it. You're telling me that they forced you to show everybody what you were listening to on Spotify, everybody in the world?
Everybody, all of your friends.
Really?
Yes.
Wow, that was stupid.
Well, and I think they kind of saw that, and they now have this private listening option, and they have an option where you can kind of turn off this whole
permanently opt out. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's probably what a lot of people are doing. And if a lot of people do that, that's really going to affect how influential this Open Graph project is over at Facebook.
That's okay. 750 million people will never bother to check their settings.
That's true. So you only are out 100 million people. And meanwhile, Spotify, after they did this whole deal with Facebook, their users jumped from 3.4 million to 5.3 in 1 week, thanks to that deal.
Because of their visibility on Facebook and how easy it was to sign up?
Exactly.
Hmm. So what does this mean? Who's this going to hurt?
Funny you should ask, because I guess it depends on who you ask. Frankly, I don't know. Do you use Last.fm?
No.
Okay, I
get too much music for free from major labels. I have, you know, CDs and digital downloads from them. I don't listen to the radio. I don't listen to any of this stuff. But it's just because I have a mountain of music and new music to listen to on my own available to me. So
right,
there's no need for me to go there.
Right. And Last.fm, it's a website where you can listen to, it's a kind of like radio, but not really. It what they call scrobbles, their little verb.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. hey, that's their word, not mine. But they created this audio scrobbler, and this is part of the problem with Last.fm. If you install the plugin for iTunes or certain other websites, when you listen to music, it will track the music you listen to on Last.fm, and it will then recommend other music to you based on what you've listened to, because they're kind of doing all of these algorithms in the background, looking at all their users and saying, well, gee, people who liked Bon Jovi also liked insert name of band here.
Beethoven.
Yeah, so That's pretty much what Last.fm does. And it's actually quite good at what it does. The question is, will this new Facebook Open Graph kill Last.fm?
Well, do they make recommendations, or is it just you have to spot your friends and click on it?
They make recommendations.
Oh, they do?
Yes. Okay. So in that regard, and, you know, it's a little bit like Pandora.
How does this help Spotify get ahead of other competitors? Who else is being hurt by this? Last.fm? What about Pandora?
Well, Pandora is Pandora part of Open Graph? I think it is. So it doesn't necessarily hurt Pandora too much.
So they can do the same thing?
Correct, yes.
All right.
I like Last.fm. I use it as a way of remembering historically what I've listened to and how often I'm listening to something. I don't really go there to listen to music, as much as I probably should. You know, basically what was said in this Hypebot story is that Richard Jones, who invented the audio scrobbler, made $38 million by inventing it and then selling it to one group, and then that group was sold to CBS. 10 years later, Facebook stands to make billions from the same exact concept. Its successful strategy to accumulate an audience so large that media services would build a Facebook scrobbling into their products rather than counting on users to install a plugin. And that is beyond true. Because if you don't get Last.fm, if you don't understand it, then you're not going to install the plugin and you're not going to help Last.fm survive.
And Facebook just gives it to you.
Yeah, they just say, look, if you're listening to something on Spotify, Pandora, Moog, Audio, we know.
So they are automatically displaying my stuff even if I don't ask for it? So it's all opt out, not opt in?
I couldn't answer that for sure. But I know Spotify was definitely opt out, and that's what had everybody up in arms.
Yeah. Who else is angry with Spotify?
Well, I can tell you more than a few people, all of these independent labels are dropping out of Spotify. And this I found fascinating, another Hypebot article where they say, look, you know, we're not getting enough money. This project is the name of the album, the record label, and they release dark wave, goth, and ambient music. So needless to say, they're somewhat niche. And here's what the CEO of Project said. For a play on Spotify, they get 0.00029.
So that's like less than 1/100th of a penny.
Correct.
Per play.
There is the math. Plain and simple.
Is that the same for everyone, or do different labels, are they able to negotiate higher rates?
I think it depends on who's negotiated for you.
Right, because they go on to say that here's the math. If you get 5,000 plays, you get $1.45.
That's right. In comparison, 5,000 track downloads at iTunes generates almost $3,000.
Right, but that's not a good comparison, because there you're buying a song to play as much as you want forever, while on Spotify you're just playing it for free like you might hear it on the radio.
Right. And they,
so they're comparing apples and oranges there.
Right. They did point out that Guardian story that we highlighted a few episodes back. Actually, I think it was months ago, where over a 5-month period, 1 million plays of Lady Gaga's hit Poker Face earned just $167.
On Spotify alone.
Correct.
That's not counting plays on YouTube or elsewhere.
Right. And I think really what somebody needs to do.
An estimation based on what they think might be Lady Gaga's rate. It's possible she negotiated a higher rate.
Yeah, I mean, I would have to dig into that a little deeper before I agreed or disagreed about that, but yeah.
Well, we don't know. We haven't seen Lady Gaga's personal contract with Spotify, so we know that we don't literally know what she's getting paid.
That's right, yes.
Right, they're just estimating what they think she's probably getting. It may only be, 0.2 of a penny, so it's not like it'd be a lot, but it's more, obviously, than 1/100th of a penny.
Right, and I guess maybe what they're saying to Project is that's how much your music is worth to our listeners. You don't attract people to us, therefore we're not going to pay you as if you do.
Right, but even if you're a big star, you're probably not getting a lot. But at the rate that they're talking about, to just get the minimum wage, you'd need about 4 million plays a month to get a minimum wage for a month, 40 hours a week, 40 weeks a month, I guess. I mean, 40 hours a week, 4 weeks a month.
Right, and you know, there have been artists and big artists who have said the same thing about Spotify and RDO and Moog and all of these services that say, look, you know what? In the digital age, we make less. We don't get the 7 to 14 cents per radio play, which is what they get now.
So why don't they all put, why would they all ever even agree to go on it, much less stay on it?
Well, the record labels are agreeing because ultimately what the record labels are saying is, look, you know, it's either that or deal with BitTorrents. You know, you're either getting paid nothing or you're getting paid a little. What do you want?
That's the only option?
Well, it seems to be right now. I mean, look, this is all moving so fast. It's moving so fast that MTV has announced a second award show in 1 year, that O Music Awards. Do you remember that?
I actually don't. I remember it now that you mentioned it, but I totally forgot it. It was some vague new media type award show.
Yeah, and you know, they are having a second one just 6 months after their first one.
Wacky.
Yeah, well, you know, Shannon Connolly, the vice president of digital music strategy for MTV, pointed to Rebecca Black, whose viral hit Friday now feels like a century ago. We're celebrating an emerging culture, and we're celebrating this thing that's happening really fast, she said. It's partly debunking the award show format once a year, sticking to all the same categories. But it's also because the space is changing so quickly. She's kind of right about that.
I mean, I don't know. It's like, What is the Oscars supposed to do? Not award Best Picture? Yeah. Well, they have the same boring categories: actor, actress, director, cinematography. It's so predictable.
I think the fact that it's changing so quickly, that space is changing so fast, that music streaming space.
So what are the digital awards that they're giving out this year?
I knew you would ask that, he said as he opened up the browser that was going to tell him. Well, one of them is the Fan Army for the Win.
What's the fan army for the
biggest fan army. So Taylor Swift, Taylor Nation, Nicki Minaj for Barbies, Lil Wayne for Team Weezy. And then there's must follow artist on Twitter, Lady Gaga, Snoop Dogg, Blake Shelton, Cher, best fan cover. So I guess somebody covered the song and on YouTube or something, and they have a whole list of that. Best vintage viral video, Digital Genius Award, best lyrics video, best
I could
keep going if you like.
No, please.
I could bore you from now until I get to most addictive social music service.
Oh, who's that? Who's nominated for that?
Turntable FM, which is very addictive. Spotify, RDO, sound tracking, and chill. The last two I haven't even heard of. So I'm going to go with Turntable.
All right. Something for you to check out, though.
Yeah. I mean, look, you know, this whole thing with Spotify and Facebook, Richard Greenfield probably put it best. He said that for Spotify, it's going to reduce their SAC.
SAC?
Well, everybody knows that's subscriber acquisition cost. And for Netflix...
How much it costs to bring in new people to their business?
Yes, correct. Yeah, so for Spotify and Netflix, it's going to lower their SAC and increase their ARPU.
What's ARPU?
The annual revenue per user. Come on, everybody knows this stuff. It all goes to the EBITDA and the BL.
So Spotify partnered with the monster Facebook, and they've increased massively the number of people that use their service. And it's easier than ever for people to share what music and stuff they're watching and doing online via Facebook's, what's it called?
Open Graph.
Open Graph, which is apparently open whether you like it or not.
That's right. You cannot shut the door on Open Graph.
All right.
Well, then we should probably move on to Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the day and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. Arrested Development. Fans of the beloved cult sitcom may soon be hearing those words again. Creator Mitchell Hurwitz was at a public reunion of the cast when he confirmed genuine, serious, very real deals in the works to bring the show back, and not just as a movie. He wants to cover the last 5 years of the Bluth clan and realized that couldn't be done in just a feature film. So they want to film a 10-episode run focusing on each of the different members of the family and what they've been doing for the past 5 years, and that would lead up to a feature film. The plan is to start filming next summer. Big Deal or Big Whoop, Michael?
Well, I like the show very much. I have friends who are fanatic about it. They tweeted me as soon as they heard about this. I'm happy for them. I'm happy for the show. I do feel like the show ran its course after three seasons. I felt like it was as wacky as it could be, and it was a good time to say goodbye. I think if it had gone on four or five seasons, it would have gotten too silly. But I want them to be excited. However, there's no deal in place. There's all sorts of conflicting rights. They don't have any particular backer. They don't have an official start date. They don't have a budget. Nobody's approved this. So I wouldn't get too excited yet. You know, let's wait till they sign on the dotted line of actually confirmed details. Right now, it's just a really great idea. I mean, they all are on board creatively. They want to do it. But, you know, this movie TV hybrid thing, this is exactly what Ron Howard, who produced the TV show Arrested Development, it's what he tried to do with The Dark Tower, that Stephen King series. Remember, they were going to have a movie.
Yeah, and how'd that work out for him?
That didn't work out too well.
Yeah, I didn't think so.
But the one thing I like about this, sorry to go on long, I know it's Big Deal, Big Whoop, it's supposed to be lightning fast, but Michael Cera was always sort of mentioned as the one holding up the movie and not wanting to be involved and wanting more money and all these things, which always seemed a little, I was like, really? And it turns out that it was a running gag that Mitchell Hurwitz and everybody was involved in the show. It was their own little gag. When they wanted to explain why it wasn't happening, they said, well, let's blame Michael Cera. And so they were all in on it all these years, which I think is hilarious. And he said, yeah, it got really ugly really fast. People were very angry at him. And I felt bad, but we just kept doing it. We couldn't stop.
Yeah, great. Hey, thanks for ruining my career. Thanks.
Well, he was in on it. I think that's very funny. So don't blame Michael Cera. It's not his fault.
DC Comics gambled. And it paid off. The venerable comic book publisher decided to start over from scratch with roughly a dozen titles. They rebooted numerous series and got back to basics. Rather than lots of crossover stunts and multi-series plot lines that forced fans to buy numerous different titles or be hopelessly confused, and without doing something gritty, radical, futuristic spin on a beloved title, they just stuck to their knitting and reintroduced characters as if they were appearing for the first time. Talk about rebooting. The gamble was taken on the flagship Justice League, which is selling 200,000 copies an issue compared to 46,000 copies a few months ago. Yes, new series often sell huge as fans buy multiple copies, but the relaunch began in June and fans are still snapping them up. Batgirl, The Flash, and Action Comics have doubled sales and are now hitting 100,000 copies. More titles will launch in coming months. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. It was a big gamble. They do this pretty regularly where it's, all right, we're going to reboot. We're going to start all over. But they really seem to have gotten back to their basics. In the last 5 years, the attempts to revitalize comics have seemed very elaborate and confusing. And in this case, they said, don't worry about anything. You don't have to have read the last 20 years of the comic to know what's going on. We're going to start from scratch. It's going to be simple. It's going to be clear. Join in with us. And, you know, that started in June. And before that, you know, sales were pretty morbid for a lot of these titles. And they've pumped up and stayed up. So it's a good sign.
Courtney Love is writing her memoirs.
Ah!
Oh, brother. That alone might send shivers down the spine of numerous entertainment figures since Love has lived hard and fast and probably has a lot of juicy stories to tell. Due next fall from William Morrow, it will cover everything from her childhood and her band Hole to, of course, Kurt Cobain and her relationship with Billy Corgan and Edward Norton, among others. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop. Hasn't she told all every step of the way?
Yeah, she tweeted it, I'm sure.
but on the other hand, you know, she's a talented artist. I like Hole. And if she can write a good book, Patti Smith's book is great about the 70s. And, you know, Courtney Love's a talented person if she gets her act together and focuses hard on it. And she might deliver, she might surprise you and deliver an actually, you know, good, solid, well-written book. She's a talented lyricist. So, you know, good luck to her.
Early renewals of TV shows is the new black. Yes, the standard of how much support a network can show a series keeps getting raised. First, an early renewal during the first season's run gave a show crowing rights about what a big success it was. Then the hot move was to renew a series the day after it debuted. Now the biggest trend is to renew a series even before it has been shown. That happened with AMC's The Walking Dead, and now it's happened again with the new drama on Stars that features Kelsey Grammer. Kelsey Grammer, as a Chicago mayor. It's called Boss. It has been renewed for a 10-episode second season even before the show debuts on October 21st. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. I think it shows that you can't just launch a show and see what happens. You've got to commit to it, give it two seasons, give it a substantial run, and show people you're behind it. It's a little silly. It's, my God, we love it, even though no one's seen it yet. But there's nothing wrong with saying, you know, we're going to give it 2 years to try and gain an audience. I think that's a smart move. You got to plan long term. You can't just launch a show and pull it after an episode. You've got to really be behind it. And for cable channels, it's a good way to show you're really committed to a series and that fans don't have to worry that if they start to watch a show, it's going to disappear 2 weeks later.
Well, Fox is actually very much behind New Girl. I think that's on Fox. But they are they renewed New Girl or picked up the back 9. In fact, they picked up the back 11 for the rest of the season.
Was that just a full season renewal? I thought they bought it for a second season as well.
Oh, no, they just picked it up the back 11.
Yeah, that's another thing. You know, they do shows for 11 episodes or 13 episodes, and now they've said we're going to give it a full season order. Why not? It launched strongly.
Yeah. In the biz, they call that, it used to be you'd do 13 episodes, and then you'd wonder whether they will pick up the back 9, and Fox picked up the back 9, decided to add 2 more shows to it, so now it's the back 11.
And the gradations that you can do are if you want to show support for a show, but you don't really want to put your money where your mouth is, you say, we're ordering more scripts. That's the big thing. We're ordering more scripts. That's the easier way to say we like a show, but not actually risk any real money.
That's right.
So there's all sorts of levels of thing. Saying you're going to have a second season before the first season debuts, that's laying it down on the table.
Lady Gaga is going to Harvard. Well, at least her business decisions will be. The Harvard Business School is doing a case study of 2 major turning points in Gaga's career. In fact, they're doing 2 case studies, which are already done. The first is how she handled losing the opening slot on Kanye West's major tour when he dropped the concerts altogether. The second turning point was the crucial launch of Gaga's second album, Born This Way, which needed to establish her as a long-term artist rather than a flash in the pan. They'll also look at her numerous brand partnerships. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, I think it's a big whoop. It's something they've done all along. It's not any particular reflection on Gaga. It just shows how complex and how many moving parts there are in the music business.
Stephen King confirms he is writing a sequel to one of his signature novels, The Shining. Remember the little boy on the tricycle in the movie by Stanley Kubrick? So did King. He always wondered what happened to that kid named Danny and his psychic powers. Now King is writing a sequel in which Danny works in a hospice and helps people cross over with his unique psychic abilities. But then the soul-sucking vampires, the Tribe, came rambling to town. Is that a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big whoop. It's not anything new for an author, especially someone like Stephen King. He has a new Dark Tower book coming out in March. I think it's March 12th of 2012. So, you know, extending a series is not really a bold, shocking thing for him.
Did you get the new Michael Jackson app? No, it doesn't cover his music or his dance moves. The Michael Jackson Doctor Trial app covers the current trial of Dr. Conrad Murray, complete with daily highlights, analysis, and timelines. It costs 99 cents and is currently the best-selling app on iTunes. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal as a smart revenue stream for news services. This one came from Fox Television Stations Incorporated. I think, you know, obviously it has a very short life. You know, it'll be gone as soon as the trial's over. But for a brief while, you know, who was that woman in Florida? I've forgotten her name already. The big trial.
Yeah, I can't remember.
I can't remember her name. I'm sure there should have been an app for her. You know, people were obsessively watching the trial. And you got a big trial, a big event. You can come up with an app. You can sell it for a few months and then it's gone. It's a smart little business move. It's a nice revenue stream. You've got all the information there. You want to repackage it, make it available smartly. You got yourself a little business.
A little morbid. Hey, you know, there was also a best-selling app for the Amanda Knox trial, but it was only in Italian. Yeah, that's an inside joke. Well, not necessarily inside, but, you know, because she's in Italy.
Yeah.
Okay. Adele is such a massive success, she's already breaking her fans' hearts.
Oh.
At the beginning of her world tour, when Adele was just a big success and not a world-beating superstar, the singer-songwriter promised she would never play the big cavernous venues and stick to relatively intimate spaces. That means thousands of fans at a show rather than, say, 8,000 or 12,000 or even more. Well, at the end of her tour, Adele confessed she had to go back on the promise. At a show in London's Hammersmith, the exact sort of venue she vowed to stay in, Adele told fans on Tuesday, "Too many people want to see my shows. This is the last time you'll catch me at a venue like this. This will be my last theater dates as I'm moving on to arenas. I'll be at the O2 Arena in February." Fans booed, and Michael told us whether this was a big deal or a big whoop.
I told you that it's a big whoop. It's almost inevitable. The O2 Arena seats, I think, like 20,000 people. I think that's the capacity. It's sort of out of your control at some point. You can't do 30 shows at a small venue when you have such demand. It's not... You know, sometimes it just feels like something you have to do. You're not trying to cash in. You're just trying to say, there's no way to satisfy all the people who want to see me without doing a bigger arena. It's a shame, but it happens at some points. And hopefully you bring it back down again and do a mix of shows. You know, at some points of your tour, you do the smaller venues and then you bump it up to big arenas or even football stadiums to satisfy that pent-up demand. Otherwise, everybody's just unhappy because they don't get to see you. So, you know, it's too bad. It's a lot more fun to see Adele in like a small club than it would be even at the Hammersmith. But what are you going to do?
Nelson Mandela's grandchildren are starring in a reality TV series. Three of his adult grandchildren, all young women, grew up in the U.S. but returned to South Africa for business and family reasons. Now they're getting their own TV show, which will...
Finally,
because I was wondering when. It will air in 2012. It was announced at a press conference and reported by a South African newspaper. The producer is Rick Leed, who has very modest reality show credits to his name, including Dr. 90210, a show about Beverly Hills plastic surgeons. This show, however, will be classy. And no, Nelson Mandela will not be appearing on it. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, I'd say it's a big whoop because it was all over the media here. You know, it was on Deadline, Hollywood, and The Wrap and everywhere. I'm like, well, where is it airing in 2012? What's going on? And I kept looking and found out the original newspaper that reported on it, this South African paper. They had a press conference, I guess, in South Africa. It's not even clear to me if what South African station has committed to this show. So I don't know if it's even going to be shown in the U.S. I don't know why they all jumped up on it and made news about it. The guy doesn't have very good credits. Come on. They can't announce an air date or a production company or the network that it's airing on in South Africa or if it's going to be picked up by a U.S. channel. Then why are you telling me?
You know, I like the fact that the grandchildren said, "We're not the African Kardashians," to which I said, "Hey, that kind of rhymes, A." And B, "Yes, you are, because we have not heard of you until now, and you're on a reality show simply because of who your family is."
That's right. And so I immediately thought, oh, maybe it's, and people were calling it Keeping Up with the Kardashians, Keeping Up with the Mandelas. But that was just a gimmick name that they gave it for the news stories. It's actually not the name, as far as I can tell. And there's no relationship between this show and that franchise. So, right. You know, Ryan Seacrest is not flying to South Africa, as far as I know.
Well, now who's the jerk? People who thought actor and writer Steve Martin was grandstanding when he announced his love for the banjo and bluegrass music have to acknowledge Martin has remained deeply committed to the genre. He's recorded albums and toured, and now he and the Steep Canyon Rangers, his band, have been named Entertainers of the Year by the International Bluegrass Music Association. They beat out Daly and Vincent, who won for 3 straight years. Steve Martin said in his acceptance speech, "I want to thank the other nominees for losing." Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. I think it shows that he really has won over the hardcore people in the industry. He's shown he's serious about this and he has talent. They wouldn't just give it to any Aravista who showed up, you know, once. He really loves the music, works hard on his playing. You know, he's a competent, decent banjo player, and he has a great band with him, the Steep Canyon Rangers. And, you know, he's really proven himself to them. And they've shown that by giving him this award.
Say goodbye to Andy Rooney, the famous curmudgeon who ended every episode of the news magazine 60 Minutes with a rambling chat on whatever topic had caught his fancy, delivered his final piece on Sunday.
You sound angry.
Well, I'm trying to be like Andy Rooney.
Oh.
You know what I don't like?
Oh, there you go. That's Andy, yeah. You know what really bothers me?
Exactly. Shows that run too long. At 92 years old, Rooney is feeling the grind of doing an essay every week, so he's stopping just shy of 1,100 different essays. The year he became the closing fixture on the show was the first year 60 Minutes ranked number one in the ratings. Decades later, it's still often in the top 20. Rooney might still pop in from time to time when the mood strikes him, but by and large, he's retiring, and he says don't bother him in any restaurants, by the way. If you see him, just leave him alone. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Does he really say that?
Yeah, that was his closing line.
Oh, that's funny. that's very good. It's a big deal. You know, he's been a fixture for, I mean, God, it's been 4 decades almost now, hasn't it? You know, I remember growing up with him, seeing him at the end of every 60 Minutes episode when you used to watch it every week. There he was. So, you know, he's definitely run his course and became sort of a, you know, stuck in his ways and sort of a caricature of himself at the end, but he maintained his dignity and God bless him.
Well, that moves us out of Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, this week, we are speaking with the CEO of a new service and new website called Prescreen, Sean Berkeson. Sean, thank you for taking the time to join us and tell us what this new service and site is all about.
Thank you guys for having me.
Now, Mashable, when they first, I guess, when you announced this service, what would you call it, a service, or is it a website, or is it a platform?
You know, it's different things to different people. I think the best way to describe it is a platform.
Well, and that's the way Mashable described it. They said it's a movie marketing and distribution platform that helps filmmakers and distributors reach new audiences. And every day I get an email in my inbox with Prescreen's movie of the day. And if I rent it on that day, or I guess it's rented, I'm not going to own it, I pay only $4. But after the first day, it costs $8, and I only have 60 days to decide whether I want to see the movie or not, because eventually, after 60 days, the movie will fall off of Prescreen. Is that...
That's right.
It says, okay. Now, what gave you the idea to put this project together?
You know, so based on my experience with technology and what I've done in the past, I ended up going to the Sundance Film Festival this past year, and a lot of my friends who are in the industry, actually, well, long story short, my dad was turning 60 years old, so I went to go skiing with him. There's no better place to go skiing than Park City during Sundance, because all the hotel rooms are taken up by industry professionals, and it is just, if you haven't been, it's a great place to go skiing during that time.
That's because nobody's on the slopes, frankly.
Nobody's on the slopes at night. There's music and movies. It's just, it's awesome. So anyways, I was there for that purpose, and a few of my friends who are in the industry gave me, they called me up and they said, man, everybody's talking about digital distribution technology in the future of the movie business. Would you mind if I set up some meetings for you? So I wasn't there to do business, but you know, just my interest in new technology and in new industries. I said, sure, why not? So I sat down with some independent filmmakers, some producers, and some distributors, And to be honest, I really didn't know much about the industry. So I was essentially a sponge. And I said, tell me what you're seeing. Where do you see this thing going? And they basically gave me the roadmap. So doing what I've done in the past, you know, actually, well, long story short, I'll back up for a second. When I left, I heard a lot of people complaining about they needed more funding. So I had, in the past, started a peer-to-peer lending platform, similar to that of Indiegogo or Kickstarter, but specifically for student loans. So that was my first thought. And then I discovered Kickstarter. They were doing a really good job. And I said, I don't want to be a Me Too. But I also discovered that particular year, there was 4,000 films submitted to Sundance. And of those, only 38 had gotten distribution.
That's about average.
Yeah, that's about average, right? And that's actually not even a bad year.
That's
so
right.
So clearly the problem wasn't even, wasn't finance. The problem was in distribution. There was all these films, but none of them were finding homes. So, you know, based on what I had done in the past, how could I help bring the tools that exist today to that industry that was not already using them? And so then we had the idea of Prescreen.
Well, now let's talk a little bit about your past, because you actually have quite a colored past. And I don't mean that in the you spent time in a jailhouse kind of way. But you were one of the founders of Groupon, if I'm not mistaken.
So I'm not considered a founder, but I was there at the very, very beginning. I mean, before Groupon was Groupon, I joined a company called The Point, which is the predecessor to Groupon. It was Andrew Mason's idea. And it was having a trouble. They didn't have a revenue model. So we were trying to figure out ways to monetize it. A couple weeks later, we had this idea, a side project called Groupon. And we started it as a way to teach people how to use The Point. And I guess the rest is history. So again, I'm not a founder. Andrew Mason, Eric Lefkowski, Brad Keywell are the founders. But I was there from the very, very beginning, before, you know, helped form the product and launch it. So it was a heck of a ride.
Well, now, one of the things that I noticed right away about Prescreen is that I can't save the movies that are recommended each day. I can't put them in a queue anywhere. I can't say, okay, I don't want to watch this now, but I want to remember this film for later. And I know there's only 60 days to watch the film. Is there a reason that there's no queue, and why only 60 days?
So the reason we don't have a queue is a couple of reasons. Number one is we want to create a call to action for the consumer. A lot of times what happens when you're online is that there's a lot of information being thrown at you all at once, and you put it aside, and then you totally forget about what you were supposed to do when you went online in the first place. So we want a lot of people. In fact, we incentivize people to buy early and often. The earlier you buy, the cheaper it is, and the longer you have to watch. So that's number one. That's the reason there's no queue. Number two, the reason it's only 60 days is because Prescreen is just a tool. It's not the end-all be-all. Filmmakers and distributors have to use a lot of different tools at their disposal to reach the right audience. For us, it's going out there, it's doing marketing and distribution in order to understand who exactly is the target audience. By incentivizing them to buy early, you now understand, and to get the conversation started, you now understand who the audience is that is interested in your particular title. But then you have the tools necessary to go out there and target your future marketing efforts, whether it's going to the right city, if you're going to be doing a limited theatrical release, it's buying the right keywords if you want to do digital distribution, and making your marketing efforts a lot more efficient, both in terms of cost and in terms of time.
So, if I get you right, this isn't about like the final step for a movie that didn't get picked up. In your mind, it's sort of a way to have sort of online audience screenings of a movie and let them see a film and see who's interested. And then when they get distribution or for wallet in a city or a college campus or whatever, that they can reach out to their audience and build up a crowd that way.
That's exactly right. So, you know, every movie's different. So that doesn't necessarily, that approach doesn't necessarily work for every movie. And, you know, different people see our platform. And for the independent filmmaker, they see this as a distribution platform. But for the larger mini majors and studios, they see this more as a promotional thing. Again, we have a finite amount of time. It's essentially having the opportunity of being in front or being on the top 10 of the rentals of iTunes for 60 days, you know, consumers start to trust our brand knowing that we're only picking quality content. They may not be interested in everything, but at least they know if they come to Prescreen, they're going to be looking at good films that either they're interested in or that other people are interested in. What we're trying to do is start that conversation around titles.
Now, you can get movie credits and earn other advantages by being social and jumping on a movie early. What is that all about?
Yeah. So again, using kind of our past experiences with other online platforms that we've used, and just being in the industry, looking at stuff that works. For us, it's not just about what works for us or what works for the filmmaker. It also has to do with what works for the consumer. If they're not interested, and they're not engaged, and they're not intrigued and willing to work on your behalf, then you know it nobody wins. So what we're trying to do is align all the interests. So the filmmaker, even us, so that we all succeed if the movie succeeds. So everybody likes to be the first to discover movies, books, and music. But no one can really prove that. In fact, I'm sure you know a lot of your friends who are the first to say, hey, you know, I discovered that band when they were nobody. And now that they're big, they're like, oh, they sold out. Well, if you can prove and incentivize people to stake their claim early and align their interests, so the bigger it gets, the cooler they look, and they have the ability to tweet and Facebook and tell all their friends that they were number 17 to discover that film, then everybody wins. So what we want to do is we want to just, aside from the vanity aspect of that, we want to reward them with discounts. We want to reward their pocketbook. If they share it with their friends, coworkers, and relatives, and it reaches a certain point, if they're in the top 5%, they get the money back that they invested in that movie, goes to their next purchase on pre-screen. Also, if you share the movie and enough of your friends, or not just that movie, but just share the service, what we're trying to do is build a community around film. And so if you share the service and people come through your link and buy, you'll get free movies as well.
Well, there's a similar company, not a similar company, but a company that also goes to film festivals and tries to mine good movies. It's called Film Movement, and they have a monthly DVD club. And they have, 12 movies a year that they release. And actually, I find that they have good taste, and like, two or three or sometimes even four of those movies end up being good to very good. I've often gotten one or two of my favorite movies of the year from those 12 films. So they've got built up a good track record for me with their picks and their taste. But you're going to do 365 films, and I'm worried a little bit about how you're going to maintain quality when you have to put up a new movie every single day. That's as much as all the major studios combined.
Sure. So movie taste is very subjective, right? Just because you like a movie or just because I think it's a good movie doesn't necessarily mean that it is. But every movie has an audience, whether that audience is 5 million people or even 500 people. The smaller the audience, the harder they are to find. So what we do is we know that you can only consume a certain amount of movies per month or per year. So we're going to put enough good movies that you're interested in front of you on a monthly basis. But we also know you just don't have the time. Even if you liked every single one of our movies, you just don't have the time to consume it. So what we do, again, is try to create that conversation. So if I know that you only like romantic comedies, I still might send you a documentary about a rodeo because you might have friends in Texas who you know that love rodeo. So you're more inclined to forward it on to them. So again, what it does is it helps us find the right audience for that movie. Whether you like it or not, at least you understand that, hey, if it's on pre-screen, it's probably a really good movie. And I know somebody who would be interested in that topic. And so that's part of the process here. It's not just putting movies that you'll like, because again, we know you can only consume so much. But putting movies in front of people and starting a conversation and so that you're more inclined to put those movies in front of the right people at the right time.
Well, and it seems as if the filmmaker keeps the rights themselves, so they're not giving the rights over.
Yeah, oh yeah, that's correct. Yeah, so it's a marketing partnership. So, the only exclusive that we ask for is within our medium. In the digital realm, we ask for the best price only for that 60 days. And the idea behind that is to get people to purchase through pre-screen so that we understand who these people are. And again, we have a privacy policy, so unfortunately we can't share exactly who these people are, but we aggregate that information. So you might know that the demographics for your particular title or for this title is, people in Northern California between 18 and 24 who like cooking, French films, and dancing. And if we know that information, we can actually quantify the market for you. So you know exactly in real time what you should be spending, where you should be spending it, and hopefully you're able to exhaust the market for your film.
Do you buy the film or do you rent it? Because you watch it streaming online, right? You don't actually physically download any film.
That's right. It's a rental stream. We looked at some of the other platforms that exist, and cable VOD, we wanted to be as consistent with the industry as possible. So they actually use buy and purchase. And so that's what we did as well. So it's buying a rental stream for up to 60 days.
And does the filmmaker get a cut of the $4 or $8 that is being paid to rent the film?
They do. We split the proceeds 50-50 right down the middle. So, you know, we align our interest. If the movie does really, really good, we both do it equally as well. But we actually go out there and we spend money on behalf of the filmmaker, and we put the movie in front of the right people to try our darndest to get as many people as we can to see the film and start talking about it.
Well, and where do you see this taking you and the company? I mean, is maybe DVD releases, theatrical releases, maybe a website?
Or is it really helping them market the film down the road?
Again, it's funny. Every conversation that I've had with content owners has been different. For smaller guys or guys who are less established, it's more of a distribution platform or marketing and distribution platform. For the bigger guys, because it's a finite amount of time, it becomes more of a promotional thing, who have talked about doing a day and date with theatrical, day and date with DVD, or even the premium VOD window. And so again, it's different things to different people. And, you know, we're happy to work with content owners and wherever they think that this platform will be most powerful for them.
Well, right now, the biggest or highest selling film on Prescreen is the Gloucester 18, which is a documentary about a group of 18 young women who all got pregnant at the same time. It's been purchased 96 times after only 3 days or 4 days, and I haven't gone back today to look at how many times it's been purchased. What is considered a success? I mean, when would you say, hey, this is successful, it sold 300, 400? At what point do you say, hey, this is working?
So for us, we're just getting started. And actually, that Gloucester, we were pretty excited. We all celebrated today. It was the first movie that we had that sold over 100. As of today, it crossed that mark. So we're pretty ecstatic. For us, it's not about the numbers. We know, you know, growing a list and growing an audience is actually pretty formulaic for us. We started with 10,000 people 2 weeks ago. We're already at 30,000 subscribers. And so what we're looking at is engagement and conversion rates. So if you look at the Gloucester 18, actually I don't have it in front of me, but the conversion rate of views of the trailer to actual purchases was extraordinarily high. And so for us, that's the metric that we're looking at. It's engagement, it's the sharing, and that is super exciting to us. Because again, right today we're 30,000 people. This 2 weeks in. We expect this to be a much, much bigger platform, ultimately reaching 300,000, 3 million people. And, you know, with the similar conversion rates, I mean, you can do the math. We expect this to be an extremely powerful platform for filmmakers and content owners.
Well, then finally, why not $5 on the second day or $6 on the third day? It jumps right to $8 that second day.
So what we discovered is movies are inherently social. And as people are talking about the movie or actually anything, price becomes less of a concern. I think people would rather be part of that conversation. And it's more than just money with movies. It's 2 hours investment of my time. And actually, that's the bigger factor. Do I really want to spend 2 hours of my life watching this particular film? You know, between $4 and $8, it's $4. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, it's not that much. Now, granted, we're very, very price conscious, and we're looking at that. But what we've noticed is already we've only been live for 13 or 14 days, and we've already seen 20% of the purchases come after day one. So what that tells us is that we are doing a really good job creating that conversation. And again, as long as you know the movie's good and the barriers are lower, because if that movie is good and all your friends are talking about it, you want to see it as well. You're more willing to spend more money. And you know, what we're trying to do is optimize the revenues for the filmmaker so that they have the ammunition that they need to continue success either with our platform or with other platforms.
Well, at Cannes this year, there was a film called 17 Girls, which was a French film and a fictional treatment of the very same story about a bunch of teenage girls getting pregnant at the same time. So you might want to check that out as well. But thanks for taking the time to join us on Showbiz Sandbox, and good luck with Prescreen.
Thanks, guys. Really appreciate the time.
Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, it was nice of him to take the time to talk with us. That was Sean Berkeson of Prescreen. I'm not sure you can... I like his faith that you can find 365 quality films that somebody will want to see. I'm not so sure it's true, since there are only about 600 movies released theatrically a year, and most of them are not good. But, you know, more power to them. It's an interesting platform. We'll have to see how it develops. They've certainly started off with a strong number of people who are signing up for free to be part of the site.
That's true. And I look forward to seeing how it progresses. Now, another strong platform is Netflix. And that is what our listener email is about this week, because the show just isn't long enough. We need to read a few of your emails. Michael, you want to take this one or you want me to?
I'll jump right in. Love the show. But what is Netflix thinking? I am an avid subscriber of Netflix, and out of the 50 plus movies on my queue, only 5 are available on instant watch or streaming. I accepted the price increase and pay more for the streaming and DVD option, mainly because my 9-year-old likes to stream kids stuff. Why would I ever sign up for a second company to watch the 5 movies on my instant queue? I will just rent them on iTunes or stream them from Amazon or another source. What a huge mistake. Plus, my parents are now going to have to choose which company to use for their DVD watching, and I would not recommend Netflix to them again. Since they have Dish Network, I think I will sign them up for Blockbuster. By breaking up their company, they are forcing customers to reshop for the best deal currently available. Great point, by the way. For many, that is not Netflix. I predict that this is the beginning of the end for this company and the joy I feel whenever I see that red envelope in my mailbox. Thanks for all your great reporting. Julie Casey.
Well, Julie, thank you for your email. The reason that I selected this email was really it epitomized all the email that we were getting that was saying, I guess a while back, you and I had this debate about whether this announcement was smart or not, because, you know, technically Netflix is increasing their revenue by 60%.
But they agree with you.
Well, what they're saying, what listeners are saying, and I would kind of have to agree, is really it's about brand equity and whether you would recommend Netflix, whether, you know, that feeling you get when you talk about a business and whether you actually feel comfortable or whether you trust a business to actually buy their product, and that this may be a short-term blip, or it could be the start of a long-term trend, and that may be what the market is reflecting.
Yeah, I mean, she makes a lot of good points. I like her point that, you know, since you have to re-sign up for it, then you get to reshop and see what other deals are available. That's a good point. I'm not sure why she would tell her parents to go to the Dish Blockbuster deal. I mean, the Netflix DVD business is still only
$8 a month. Julie Casey does not like Netflix anymore.
Right. She's on the company's just as good. If you only want DVDs, which I imagine her parents do, then they still have all the great options of DVDs that they did before, which I think is a bigger catalog than you get through the Blockbuster deal. But now she's unhappy with them and says she doesn't want to recommend them. And that's definitely something for them to be concerned about.
That's right. And you know what? We are concerned about what you think. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can vent. You can complain. You can do, you know, just send us all of your thoughts about the show or some of the subjects we talk about on the show, and we'll read your email or even listen to your voicemail on a future episode. You can leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's toll free, 888-567-7263. You know, you can also subscribe to our podcast in the iTunes or Zune Marketplace. You can rate and review the podcast there. You can subscribe in your RSS reader. All of those links, as well as links to all of the news stories we discussed on today's episode, can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find ways to follow us on Twitter. Our username is showbizsandbox. Or on Facebook, again, our username is showbizsandbox. Now, the music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. I'd like to thank Sean Berkeson for joining us. He, of course, can be found over at Prescreen, prescreen.com. We'll place a link in the show notes. Michael is over at michaelgiltz.com. All of his writing and all of his work can be found there. Some of my writing can be found on Celluloid Junkie. And until next week, play nice.
Longest show ever.
Hey, yeah.